I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, welcome along to Writer's Routine. This week we'll take a look inside the working day of debut Australian literary sensation Trent Dalton. His novel Boy Swallows Universe, it won the Debut Fiction Award and the Book of the Year at the Australian Indie Awards. It went straight into the top 10, it sold over 100,000 copies, and you can hear how he wrote it. We'll talk about why he's been sitting on this book for a few years, waiting to finally get the experience and the skill and almost really the courage to be able to tell it. We'll also get a lot of detail, I mean a lot of detail, about all aspects of his writing routine. And you can hear why his work as a journalist helped him with the snappy part of his writing.
Keep your stories contained. The best stories can be summed up in three words. You know, man conquers moon. And you should be able to sum your life up in three words if you thought about it, you know, because that would mean that you've led a big and grand life, you know, and it's sort of, I loved that notion.
So stay there, it's all on the way in this week's Writer's Routine. Yes, hello, thanks for coming along. This is Writer's Routine. My name's Dan Simpson. It's the show where we take a sneak peek inside the working day of some of the most successful authors around to try and steal some of the snippets of their writing life. Now, if you've been binging the show recently, and I have noticed that quite a few people have from all over the world, which is amazing, but if that is you, if you've heard quite a lot in the last few days, and if you want to say thanks for that, remember the easiest way is to leave the show a review over on Apple Podcasts. Find Writer's Routine on there, drop a few words, and let us know what you think. 5 stars is always very helpful with that chart as well. It lets other people know who we are, what we do, and maybe they can get some of the writing advice that they need to tell their story. Also, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show, if that is Spotify, if it's on Acast, on Radio Public, if it's on Apple as well. Subscribe so that way the new episodes download automatically every week. Now, the point of the show is to take a look inside the working day of a successful author. And we've got one of the most successful ones around right now at the moment, actually. Not long-term success, but like a short burst of immense acclaim. Trent Dalton, yeah, his debut novel is Boy Swallows Universe. It's literary fiction. It tells the story of Eli in Brisbane in 1983, who is kind of working through a pretty complicated family life. He's trying to not be coaxed into dealing drugs, and he's also having to save his mum, who's in prison. It won the Debut Fiction Award and the Book of the Year at the Australian Indie Awards. I've already said it went straight into the top 10, and it sold over 100,000 copies, which is a lot. If you're not really aware how many books need to be sold to make something a success, I'll just say it's a lot less than 100,000 in the first few months of it being published. Now, Trent works for the Australian magazine. He's won numerous awards for his journalism as well. And you can hear how that impacted his writing, not just in the way he told his stories, but also how he needed to fit his storytelling around all the other bits of writing that he needed to do throughout the week. Now, Trent is one of those people that's just full of energy, full of enthusiasm. He's got that brilliant, casual, calm excitement that comes with being Australian, I think. I don't think I've ever met an Australian who's grumpy at all. He's the type of person that if you feel a little bit exhausted, you just want to spend a few minutes in his company and you get recharged. He's kind of like a battery, the guy. I mean, he's amazing. I loved my time with him. We get right into the minutiae as well of writing routines, talking about the very specific desk that he works on, how he breaks up his day hour by hour, minute by minute. And Trent loves his family. And it seems that most of his writing is almost a battle inside himself between the story that he really wants to tell, but also wanting to spend every waking minute that he can with his family, the family that he loves so much. It's a really amazing tale of kind of being a dad, really, Trent's story. You can find out how he manages to work through that and get his words down on a page in just a sec. Also, a quick warning, it's a little bit of a sweary one as well. It's not too bad. There are a few F's and Jeff's floating around. So if you are in the car with your family, maybe you want to kind of, you know, keep an eye out for that, mute it very quickly, or just listen in your own time. We'll get a top writing tip as well from one of the biggest crime writers working today after we dive into it with Trent Dalton, the author of Boy Swallows Universe. I promise you're going to love this. And we start, as always, with what Trent sees around him in the place where he sits down to write.
Oh, what a great opening question, and I love that because I'm all about objects, actually, Dan. It's funny you even say that. I actually believe that objects actually have stories, all that we carry on storytelling through objects sometimes. I've done a whole podcast, it's called The Theory of Objects, that I did once, and it's all about the power of objects, and if we don't talk about the things that are around us, such as, this is why I love your question, then we don't carry on those stories. So you need to pass the story on with an object sometimes. Anyway, I've got an amazing array of objects. There's all the books I love. There's the works of Steinbeck and Cormac McCarthy and some great Australian writers that I love. I've got a bunch of vinyl records, a lot of Springsteen, Pearl Jam, a lot of alternative rock, a little bit of Bangles in there. I love the Bangles. You know, a lot of deep cut kind of stuff. A record player, and then there's a DeLorean time machine car. And there's images of, straight out of my head, there's usually a collage of whatever I'm trying to write at the time. So for the book I wrote called Boy Swallows Universe, I put up there on this, basically on a wall in front of where I write, I put up everything that evokes that era. And that era that I write about in that book is 1980s Brisbane, Australia. So I'm putting things up there like paddle pop sticks, which are like chocolate ice creams in Australia, or you'll put up a picture of In Excess, or you'll put, you know, just anything that evokes that, the spirit of that time. To my right, however, is, you know, sometimes the most important thing, which is basically images of the people I love, because now I'm going to get deep on you here, mate. Sorry, but it's basically, I'd sit down before I write, which is basically kind of in the rumpus area. We call it a rumpus room in Brisbane. You guys have their rumpus room? You know, your rumpus room, yeah. And it's funny because I said that in America and people are like, what the hell are you talking about? What do you call it, a rumpus room? And I would go downstairs to the rumpus room each night between 8 till 10, and it's just downstairs, and I would think about the people I love in my life, and I would think about the things, particularly these two daughters I have called Beth and Sylvie, and I'd think about them, and I'd think about the many courses of my life, that my paths that I could have taken in my life to not have them in my lives. And that was a very powerful thing. So I'd think of them, and the power of that would shoot through my fingertips. I swear to God, man, it would shoot through my fingertips onto the keyboard and onto the page. That was a very powerful feeling. So I try and keep pictures of them around me. And I've got this, and then I try and keep things around about my parents and people I love. So there's a stonefish. You know, you're familiar with like the stonefish. It's a very dangerous creature in Australia. You step on a stonefish, you could quite possibly die. My old man, though, he was a fisherman. He's like a sort of basically a mud crabber. He sort of fished for mud crabs in this place called Pumiston Passage at Bribie Island, 1 hour north of Brisbane. And he's not with us, right, my old man now, but he used to have this stonefish that he kept in a jar of big sort of like a museum-like jar of preservation liquid. And on top of this jar, he wrote the words Keef, like K-E-E-F, like Keef. And he was a sometimes lonely man. He lived up in this Bribie Island unit, housing commission unit, all by himself, fished, caught mud crabs, drank a bit, used to smoke a lot before he stopped smoking. And he'd talk to this stonefish, Keef. And he called him Keef because it reminded him a bit of Keith Richards from the Rolling Stones. He's a big Stones fan. But this stonefish has that lived-in look of Keith Richards. And, mate, it's become my prized possession. It's like, it's the thing. Oh, man, I'm getting emotional just thinking about that right now, because it was this thing I thought, my brothers and I thought, you know what? And we put it on his coffin at his funeral. And it's like this thing, Keith. And it's become this kind of totem now. It's this weird thing to me now. It's like I write with that thing, and sometimes I keep Keith in the shed, and sometimes I bring him out and I sort of just hang with him, and it's like I'm hanging with my old man. It's sort of, so that's around me when I write, man. It's like I really need to write from really raw, like honest, emotional places, and I do whatever I can. If I need to put things around me to tap into that place, I will bloody do it. So I'm sorry, I know that's a long answer to your excellent first question. I love detail, and I love that you've set what you're doing with that question is the thing I love doing as a writer, which is setting the scene, and it's fantastic. So
what I love about that is, you know, when we started and you were saying you've got all these things that jog your memory, these objects that are drawing emotions out of you, would I see anything aside from the pictures of things that are perhaps to do with your story? Is there any structure towards the plot that surrounds you? Do you have a big whiteboard, perhaps? Are there post-it notes strewn all around the walls, jogging your memory, telling what's coming next? Here's what I'm writing. Is there any structure, or is it just things to tug at your emotion?
No, there's structure. There's it's things like, let's say, it's also things that appeal to me, and I'm all about wonder, right? So I would have, and I've since changed this little collage wall because of the second book I'm writing, and so it's now about to be, it's almost ready for a repaint. You know, it's really funny, it's really cool that you talk, because I love it, but for quite some time, I'm telling you, this thing was covered, not just one wall, it took over my entire sort of rumpus area, and you'd go down there, and my wife would say, Trent, that's actually going to scare some kids who are some of my kids' friends who are going to come over and stay. And it's just pictures of, sometimes it'll be a picture of like an old 1920s kind of vaudeville or kind of, I don't know, let's call it like a freak show person or something. I'd put a picture like that up. Or I've got pictures of astronauts up there. I've got pictures of, you know, I've got old things like from World War II and things that inspire me. But it's just usually just novelty kind of things that inspire me and go, that are filled with story. You know, you can just look at it and go, there's a story in that. So that's what I'd sort of draw on if... you know, then I might have a picture of, let's say, I don't know, Daniel Day-Lewis as a character in a film or something. I go, that guy is kind of like this guy that I'm talking about. I will do that. I'll absolutely do that. And, you know, I don't know. It's very powerful to have those things just to look at and remind you and go, that's what I'm talking about. So things that evoke feelings, you know. So this one was, you know, it's universe and big. I wrote so ambitiously with this one. So I did have pictures of space and pictures, even though it's a love story, it's a suburban love story that I wrote, and it's a story about family and brotherhood and the ways you can take love anywhere. A kid will take love wherever he will get it, and that's, you know, that's kind of what I did in real life. But I will put things on there that are big and expansive and ambitious. So a galaxy theme, and you know, the opening page while I was writing this to my you know, the home screen to my computer, to my, I just wrote this on a bloody Windows Surface Pro. Can you believe that? I was like this cramped little Windows Surface Pro, and the opening screen of that was basically the thing I saw in my head whenever I'd sit down to write, and it was the most expansive galactic scene you've seen in your life, because that is how big I wanted the book to be. I wanted it to be a story of suburban Brisbane, Australia, that takes readers all the way to the edge of the universe. That was my ambition. But, you know, and so it was really important each day to open that laptop and go, that's where I'm going. That's where I'm going to take readers, if I can. You know, I don't know whether I reached that, but man, that's where I wanted to go.
I'm so happy with the detail that you're bringing to this, and it's going to make me very excited for this next answer, which is the point of the show. So okay. We're called Writer's Routine.
Yeah.
Talk me through yours, Trent. The moment you wake up to the moment that you go to bed on a day when you are sitting down to write, how does it work? Leave no stonefish unturned. Really nitpick at everything here. How does it look for you?
Man. Okay, my book, it's so, I love your love of details, man. I go on about that in my book so much. There's a guy named Slim Halliday in my book, and he's a real life figure from my life. He's a guy who was basically my babysitter in the 1980s. He was in his mid-70s when I knew him. But in the 1950s, he's very famous in Brisbane, Queensland, Australia, as the Houdini of Boggo Road, right? Which was this notorious prison that you couldn't escape from. And Slim Halliday, my babysitter... escaped from that prison twice in the late 1940s, and he became a legend. But one thing I have Slim saying in my book, because he was all about this in real life, about noting things, I have him talking about details. And if to a con, to a someone in prison, details are so important. So the kid in my book is always writing to prisoners, and Slim is always telling the kid, Eli Bell, the hero of my story, he's always telling him, make sure he's writing to this. He sort of made this friend inside a prison. He's writing to him, and Slim always says, make sure you put in the details. So if you don't just write that you went down the shop yesterday to buy some lollies, really tell them what type of lolly it was. Was it salted caramels? Was it licorice? Was it freckles? You know, it was like, really put that detail in there. So it's like, it's everything I'm about. Everything I'm about as a journalist is about details. So anyway, let's begin. Let's begin the day, though.
Go through it detail by detail.
Time
to wake up?
All right, I'll wake up at 6 a.m. And that's getting earlier because of my eldest daughter, Beth, has started high school, and she's got this 1 hour kind of march into high school. So she's really responsible, and she's always up well before my wife and I. It's a simple suburban home in the most kind of peaceful part of Brisbane. And to my right is Lonesome Dove is to my right. There's a biography on Warren Beatty to my right. This is on my bedside table. And there's a whole bunch of notepads because, mate, my ideas come in that beautiful mystery space between going fully to sleep and like just going to bed and going to fully to sleep and then waking up and, you know, waking from sleep. You know, like that beautiful, you know, amazing kind of lemon light time of both sides of the day where your mind is relaxed and wonder creeps in, you know, true illumination and true inspiration creeps in. So I have all these notepads, and I've got so many, I can't even tell you. I don't even know what problem with that is that I need to kind of file these things properly, but I've just got random thoughts, and I've like, oh, what about this idea? What about that idea? And if the thing, and it's this idea of head hours that you need to constantly be thinking about the story that you're writing. And because your brain is this gift that you don't even know about. You know, I don't know anything about what is in here, and it frightens me sometimes, man. I swear to God. And but I trust it so much because it just gives me these gifts. I swear to God. And I just go, you know, that book, there's so many things in my book, this first thing I wrote, you know, where the answers came about things I needed. And you just, it's in that moment. So I have a bunch of those notepads. Wake up. I'm a Weet-Bix kid. Go out. Oh man, I just like I've had Weet-Bix for like all my life. Weet-Bix is like an important part of my day. You know, two Weet-Bix. I've cut down from three Weet-Bix to two. Whack a bit of honey on that, and even then, I'm thinking story. I'm trying. The biggest thing with me is to make sure I'm engaging with the beautiful people around me and not constantly in this thing here, because my wife spots it a mile away. She'll go. I'll be looking at her, and I have this distant look in my eyes, and she'll go, you're thinking about the story, aren't you? And she's like, come back here. You need to be present right now. Here's what we have to do. We've got to get, you know, and it's literally, my day is insane, man. It's like, so it's getting my kids to school. I go down. First thing, I iron their clothes. I iron their school clothes. Come back up. I fix their breakfast, and they'll have either Weet-Bix as well or Vegemite toast. I'll get ready to work myself. My day job is a journal. I write for, you know, long form journalism for a magazine called The Weekend Australian Magazine. It's an amazing kind of magazine, similar to, you know, like your Sunday Times magazine or something like that here. And I'll sort of get into my, you know, outfit and all that. I'll be thinking about story that whole time. Then get in my car, Toyota Corolla, leave this place called The Gap, and then I'll go all the way into Bowen Hills, which is the home of basically the Australian newspaper that I write for. And there, you know, you're plugging away. I'll go and work out the story that I'm doing. I write a lot about ordinary people. I'm big on just, you know, turning the ordinary into the extraordinary. So, and a lot of social issues type stories. Generally, I'll be going out and doing some big epic 4-hour interview where I sit down again, talking about details. I go into these people's living rooms and I go, hey, would you mind if I hear every last detail about your life? And that's what I do. And I go, and they proceed for the next hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, the longer the better, the longer the better. And they tell me their life story. And all the while, I've got my recorder on and I've got a notepad beside me. I'm not taking notes. I'm not taking shorthand. I'm writing about all of the things, the objects that are on their walls. It feeds back to that great first question you asked. I do the same thing, man, with every person I've ever interviewed. character and human nature is so better expressed, not through the words we say, but the things we keep dear to us. And that's a very important thing to remember as a journalist, but also as a writer. And so I would be writing about, why have they framed that person's picture? Why do they keep that model car on the mantelpiece? Why do they have that poster? Why do they put a bird on there? And I'll sometimes ask him, like, what is that crow? Why have you got a crow on your wall? Oh, okay, I'll tell you about the crow. And it's like, bang. It's like, it's just character, right? And then that feed has always fed back into my sort of more creative kind of writing. Like, you know, so it's a really cool thing. And
let me just quickly, when you're, so working as a journalist, you're writing long form stories.
Yeah.
Just really niche and quite nerdy.
I love niche and nerdy.
Are you writing one a week, or are you thinking more long term? Maybe you'll be writing one, but you've also got the plannings of four more articles on the go.
Yeah, bang. Well said. Yeah, I'll do a. Let's say, I don't know, great British novelist has come to Australia, and my editor wants me to write a profile on them. I can write that in about a week, but at the same time, The last story I've written is a story about a place called Groot Island, and it's a tiny island on the very north of Australia, and there's an indigenous population there, and there's about 1,100 people on that island, and 186 of them suffer this disease called MJD, Mercado-Joseph disease. So I'll fly up, you know, this will be a bigger piece, so this might take you a month or so, right? So I find out about MJD. And I go up there and I meet this guy Buckler, and he takes me into the bush, you know, he takes me into the wilderness, and we're looking for fish and toxins and insects in the Australian wild that he believes are like black magic, like stuff that is going to cure his own disease. So that's my day, you know, it's pretty freaking cool day job that I go. So, but talk about sort of, but in practical sense, that will be, okay, I spend about 3 days doing that, getting the story, right? Going to Groot Island. It's a real mix, but you're always wanting to have multiple things on the go. So that's just, you know, and that's my sort of day job. I'll knock off from that. I'm useless. I don't offer anyone anything after 4 p.m. I don't even try and force myself to work if I'm past even 3 p.m.
But it sounds all consuming. It sounds like when you are in the office, or when you're, you know, flying up to islands to check out strange disorders and diseases, you're focused on that, which then leads me to wonder, at 4 o'clock when you do knock off, how easy is it for you to switch on to creative writing modes?
I mean, there was 1 year, and it was 2017, and when I was juggling this really consuming, all-consuming day job as a long-form magazine journalist, and I still do it. I've been doing it forever. I'm a journo for 20 years, but that time when I was writing Boyce Waller's Universe, I would come back, then I'd drive in, you know, wrap my arms around my daughters and try and spend as much time with them as I could, whilst not thinking about this story, helping them with their homework, and then helping my wife with dinner. She works as well. And, you know, it's total madness. And then, you know, this was this precious time. There's about this 8 till 10 sort of at night time that my wife and I had that was just to us. And I would say to her, after putting the kids to bed and really sort of just being present with them, which is a massive important thing, because I have this theory, right? Like, you imagine, okay, you get to go to London. I'm this Brisbane guy, gets to go to London, and, you know, and you know, all these fantastic things have happened in Australia to my book. But how horrible if my kids look back and go, Dad was totally never around. And, you know, like, what an awful thing. Like, nothing is. There was this definitive moment. I remember I was writing Boyce Waller's Universe, and my daughter Sylvie was dead set, man. Like, there's a window in front of where I write, and she was skipping. She's skipping. And it was such a symbol of ambition versus what you're actually really here for. The only thing I'm here to do, man, I swear to God, is to be a dad to those beautiful girls. And second thing just behind that was to write Boyce Waller's Universe. You know what I mean? It's like that. And but that thing about being a dad to them, in that moment I was going, damn, no matter what happened to that book, is it as important as me going out and playing and skipping with her? You know what I mean? So what value do you put on not doing that with her? And that's a fascinating thing I'm sure all writers go through. But I would say to my wife at around 8 p.m. after dinner, we're watching telly, right? And it's like, you know, dodgy Australian reality TV show, let's call it, you know, take your pick, Married at First Sight. And you're sitting down and you're watching this mindless stuff because your life's so insane. And it's so easy to be ensnared by that and to just go, look, I do just need to switch my brain off. But in that year, I did manage to just every freaking night just go, darling, Fiona, I love you so much and I want to be here with you watching The Block. Like, I would love nothing more, but I do need to go downstairs to that bloody rumpus room, slip on the kind of metaphorical Dunlop volleys. Do you have Dunlop volleys here?
No, I kind of understand. So you were talking sports shoes. Trainers.
Sports trainers. Dunlop volley is a kind of iconic shoe in Australia that our best tennis players, Rod Laver, John Newcomb, wore in the 70s. And it's, yeah, basically made by Dunlop tires.
So it means I'm getting to work.
I'm going to work.
On.
I'm putting them on. But also the kid in my book wears Dunlop volleys, okay. Right? So I'm literally sort of going into that space. And I actually wear Dunlop volleys as an adult. I love the shoe. Most practical shoe you could ever. And they cost about $20 from Kmart. So I would just say to her, like, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry if you can just let me do this. And it became really stressful. Like, it's really tough on her because it's like, and at that time, man, I don't know it's going to go anywhere. It's such a chancy thing. You're sort of just going, and she's like every book that everyone writes in Australia goes nowhere. You know, that's how it works. It's sort of like, and I'm saying to her, but I would say like an idiot, man, I'd say every now and then I go, but Fee, what if it got published and, you know, it might even make some money for us and it might actually be all worthwhile. And we're like laughing and just going, yeah, right, as if.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Remember, if you've got a writing tip which has really helped you get your story down, something that helps you work through the day, a little trick maybe, a little tip that you heard that you just want to pass on to us, it could be something tiny that just gets you going. It helps you get your ideas from your head down onto the page. Tell me and I'll share it with the writing community that we've got here. All you need to do is let me know what it is over at writersroutine.com, and it could be anything. It doesn't matter at what stage of writing you are. You could have just started, or you could be one of the most famous crime writers around.
This is Jeffrey Deaver. I'm the author of The Never Game by HarperCollins, and it is available now. My tip for writing is this: plan out what you're going to write ahead of time. Remember that rejection is a speed bump. It's not a brick wall. Keep on writing and write every single book as if it were your last.
If you missed Jeffrey Deaver last week on the show, loads of golden nuggets of help there. Make sure you catch up. You can do that on Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your shows from. The full episode is there for you to find as well at writersroutine.com. And that is a place you need to go to let me know your writing tip. Right, let's get back into it with Trent Dalton then, the author of Boy Swallows Universe, one of the biggest books to come out of Australia in some time. I think it won the Debut Fiction Award at the Australian Indies, also the Book of the Year. It sold over 100,000 copies. And in this half, we talk about editing and why for him that's one of the most important parts of writing. And with editing comes writing concisely. It comes with the snappiness of his words. We chat about that as well, and why he thinks the best stories are always as tight as they could possibly be. And we pick things up talking about the big trips that he has to do on a journalist. Remember this earlier on, he was saying that he needed to fly up to some island off the coast of Australia and look at some really rare disease and talk to the people that live there. Well, we kind of chat now about what he has to do when he's uncovering those big stories for journalism and how he fits telling his own story around that.
All through that crazy stuff, on the drive, on the flight to Groot Island, or on the drive to the person's living room that I'm going to go in, I'm still thinking about that story. And it literally is break it down into, I reckon in 2 hours I've got 2,000 words. I reckon I've got 2,000 words, maybe 1,000 even, that'll do. But I need to know. I need to not be dicking around by the time. I need to make sure in that 2 hours I know exactly that next passage. And in my book, it was this kid Eli Bell who's on an odyssey, you know. And it's a great. I just love any odyssey. So I love. It was a matter of what is he doing next, and how important, and what also is the first layer, second layer, third layer. Does it have every one of those three elements that I want to put into this piece? Does it still talk about the thing that I'm getting at, the mysteries, but also the bigger picture things that I was trying to talk about. I'm trying to talk about in this book big things about the ways in which a kid can find love wherever he can get it. And I'm talking about the ways that bad can become good again, and the ways in which it's the bad stuff in life that can sometimes be the good stuff, and the bad shit won't be our destruction, it will actually be the making of us. And it's like, but is that little 1,000 words still going to somehow tap into that, and is that going to help Eli discover those things along the way? So you're thinking about that eating Weet-Bix, you're thinking about that in the Toyota Corolla. So when it comes time, as you say, you flip open that thing, and I would do that thing about, I'd think about my daughters, the life I could have led. My book's really kind of, you know, it's about 50% fact and 50% total my wild imagination just going nuts and having fun and really enjoying itself. But I would think about that crazy life I could have led and how dangerous and certain things that happened in my life could have been. Then you get that jolt of electricity, that jolt of electricity that kind of gets you in the zone, and then, but you already know what you want to write. And then what I would do, though, that's why my book doesn't read like Hemingway, man. It is just heart and soul. It's just like, what I would do, I swear to God, was how freaking honest can I be, and don't let great, marvelous, like wordy, flowery writing getting in the way of your heart. You know, it's like, man, you need to tap into the source of yourself and I just soul coughed. I soul coughed. I was just like rip out my heart and feed it to anyone. That's what I did with that book. I swear to God, it was just like, so don't get bothered about, oh, does that sentence read well? Can I swear on this? Like,
yeah, you have many times.
So. Fuck, who cares about if it reads? You know what I mean? You're telling a story, man. You're a storyteller. It's like, is it a good story? You know, fuck all. Like, it's seriously, I get so, you know, I just like, man, the best writers for me are just the guys who, yeah, I love it when the words are beautiful too. I love it. That's brilliant. If you can get both, fantastic. But this one, mate, it was just like, it will be powerful and poetic in itself because people will realize how true it is. You know, well, like true in the sense of life has to be true, not just honest true, you know?
Well, let me slightly unpack that for a sec then, because, you know, this is literary fiction.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you've said that, you know, I don't care about the words. I don't care how it reads. I don't care if it's poetic. But the thing is it comes across like you do care.
Oh, really? So, really? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So did you pick that up in the edit then? we often on the show, a lot of writers have talked about the vomit draft, which is just your first draft, just get it all out there, get those words on the page, then you can really always fix it later.
Yeah, yeah.
How much would you go along with that idea? If you're not caring about how it reads when you get them down, are you fixing that in the edit?
Okay, good point. One other thing I do, I've got it, I would email myself the manuscript every time. So, again, when I've got my free time or something, I might flip open that ongoing draft, and it's literally on my phone, and I'm scrolling down. I keep working. I need to work on better tools. I swear to God, Surface Pro was ridiculous. It was so like dysfunctional. It just would always freeze. It was horrible writing that thing. But I am going back through that last 1,000 words. You're right, and I do care about it eventually. You know what I mean? I do. It's I care about it tomorrow, man. To be honest, that's such an insightful thing you've said, because whilst I'm trying to be all brave and kind of when I'm sitting down there and like, I don't care about the results, it's like, I need to get this out. And I kind of did. Like, I mean, it's quite a cathartic kind of old story I did. I had to unpack a lot of rocks I was carrying around, man. Like, you got to understand. But it's like, so I put great value on the getting it out. But yeah, the next day was when I was like, oh, actually, what was that nonsense? I'm telling you, the things I cut were highly ambitious sort of things that I didn't necessarily change too much, but I'd probably just go delete, delete, delete. You know what I mean? Let's leave that. But it was a writing style that I never get to indulge in my nonfiction. You know, it was a writing style that I could go, you know, this is how I love to kind of imagine the world, and this is how I want to write about the world. And it was kind of poetic, and it's kind of, I did write a lot of poetry back in the day, really, really bad stuff that would be vomit. It was like vomit poetry. I probably did all my vomiting, you know, in the kind of early 2000s as a 20-year-old. And it was like, but yeah, so I guess that's it. It's that thing on the phone where you're going, and you know, it works in reverse though too, man. Like you don't even know what you did. So by the time, so I would write from 8 till 10, and then I'd just like, it's like, okay, I'm done. I'm falling asleep. Like I'd write, and I'm done. You know, and it would only always happen around 10 p.m. And so by the time you do wake up and you're having the Weet-Bix or you're at work and you're grabbing the coffee, right, you're literally waiting for the coffee to be made, and then you pull up your manuscript and your last 1,000 words, last 2,000 words, and sometimes you'd have this feeling, go, holy shit, that was pretty cool. Like, that's a really interesting thing you're playing with there. And that was a really cool way of saying it. And like, yeah, go with that. I'm such a confidence player, man. Like, I need to feel like in myself that this is going really good places. And I need, like, if someone shatters my kind of confidence, I'm just like, I'll crumble. And the whole house of cards that is my internal freaking psyche, that who I am, my heart, I'm talking about this thin glass heart I have inside me, will shatter into tiny pieces and I'll stop writing.
Welcome to being a published author, I think.
The title of my book, Boy Swallows Universe, it's straight from... Firstly, it's the idea that, look, swallow it all. You know, life is here to be just eaten up. And so take the good stuff and the bad stuff and just own it all. It's really about that. But also, that title is a three-word headline. And that's the first thing you learn in a journal. And that's the first rule I broke 20 years ago, is keep your stories contained. The best stories can be summed up in three words. How would you sum up your own life? That's what Eli Bell's always talking about in the book. It's like, can you sum up your life in three words? And that's how he ends up with Boy Swallows Universe.
How would you sum up your life in three words?
Trent, London visit right now. Because that's all I'm thinking about. Now, let's go better than that. Trent loves Fiona. That's it.
That's,
I tell
so
you that.
Sweet.
That's cheesy, mine, man. But that's a fact. What's yours, man?
Podcasts, little money. That probably podcasts for free. It's probably something
I'm
like
just
that.
Tapping you on the knee there, man. I love that. I know, because these things do define. Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's like, how does my life feel right now? And, you know, yeah, you could easily sum it up like that. I love that. But Eli Bell, that's this point that he reaches, it's like Boy Swallows Universe. And it's like, yeah, you're the best stories, the biggest stories, you know, man conquers moon, Hitler invades Poland. It's like the biggest can be summed up in three words. And you should be able to sum your life up in three words if you thought about it, you know, because that would mean that you've led a big and grand life, you know, and it's sort of, I loved that notion. But like me in real life, and like Eli Bell in my book, he sort of goes on this massive journey. It's got this sort of Dickensian thing in my book where the things are planted in the first sort of, you know, 50 pages of my book that come back 400 pages later. And the kid has this pretty long arc of a journey. And, you know, like me, he becomes this journo. And just like me, he's constantly told by the editors, you're writing too flowery. You need to be more concise. Like, what's the pub version of your story? You know, have you heard that? That's a journo thing. Like, tell me that story as if you're just telling me at, you know, that story in the bar. And that's a really powerful thing. But that is a thing I just am physically incapable of doing, because my storyteller comes in. So I'm a shocking news writer on my paper. It's like, people don't come to me to write, like, something major has happened, let's go to Dalton. Like, hey, Dalton, quickly, we need 500 words in 20 seconds, you know, 20 minutes. I'm the guy you go to. It's like, hey, Trent, actually, this big thing has happened. Can you write a piece about what that felt like and what it feels like? And, like, that's me. I can do that, you know, and I'm really love doing that. But for that, I do need a few words. I need 2,000 words, you know, and sort of, it's sort of, that's how I write. But the kid is constantly trying to, kid Eli Bell is constantly trying to get away from that and go, God, stop being so emotional, stop crying, stop. But that's just me. And at a certain point, I've just owned that and gone, shit, I am that guy. I am the guy who freaking cries when I interview someone for 4 hours. And then sometimes I freaking cried when I'm writing my journalism, you know, and that's when I know the story's working, you know. So it's like, just feel it and just feel it all. And that's the big thing, you know. Yeah.
This book has Congratulations, has got quite some success. I mean,
thank you.
Book of the Year over in Australia.
Yeah. It's the Indie Book Awards Book of the Year, which is kind of a thing. Like, it's judged by the independent booksellers all across Australia. And they go, hey, we think this is Book of the Year. Yeah, so it's a really cool.
And
it was amazing.
Sold, 100,000 copies, which is just astronomical. And you were speaking earlier on about you with your wife laughing. Think, look, I know I've got to take this time away from you, but whatever gets published.
And
it's not just being successful commercially, but as I say, critically, as literary fiction. What do you think it is about this that is captured a moment, that is captured an imagination, that is selling well? And then, to expand on that, when was the moment for you that you realised, actually, this could do something?
Oh, dude, you're so great. I love this. It's such a great question. It's you know, when it was for me, where, because I sent it off to Catherine Milne, who's the head of fiction of HarperCollins in Australia. And she'd sort of come up to, she'd read my journalism. She'd sort of said, look, I think you've got a book in you. And then I then told her, right, okay, Catherine, here's the deal. There was a period in my life where I was raised by drug dealers. And once my brothers and I found a secret room, I kid you not, this is no shit. This is like, it sounds ridiculous, but we found a secret room beneath this guy's house that my mum had fallen in love with. And he was kind of a father figure in my life that I loved dearly and still do. And am very extremely grateful to this man for a lot of the things he's given me. We found a secret room, and inside that secret room, which was basically a safe room for him in case he was ever in a jam, we'd find out later. There was one thing in that room, and it was a red telephone, an old 1980s red telephone. And that's a profound kind of life-changing moment for me, because it's the birth of imagination and the birth of almost the time I've become a writer, because you suddenly realize nothing is as it seems and there are other universes in this world. And the interesting thing about that is that I told her this, and then she goes, you got to write this stuff, but I still don't know where it's going to go. It's quite ambitious, this thing I wrote. You know, it was an all or nothing pursuit, because look, I was reasonably okay with just, okay, if you don't like it, that's fine. I need to get it out anyway. So if I am going to get it out, I'm going to freaking go as big, you know, I'm going to go for the fence. And then I sent it off, and then there's this quiet period while she's sort of just consuming it. Then I'm at a little sushi train with my daughters, Beth and Sylvie, and I get this email, man, and she's writing from the bus, and she's just finished the book, literally finished the last page, and she's just freaking losing her mind. It's one of the best emails I've possibly ever received. I received a really great email from Clive James once, that's right up there, but that was an amazing email, and that's when I went, oh my God, and that was almost like, what the fuck have I done? Because it's very deep, man, this thing I've done. And my beautiful family who read that, who would read it, would totally recognize, one, themselves, situations, things. So then you're suddenly like, oh my God, almost like my dreams have come true, but like, careful what you wish for, man. It's like, because then I had to go quickly, like, all right, Mom, firstly, you have to read this thing I've done. I'm sorry you didn't raise a carpenter. I could have built you a cupboard, but I wrote you a bloody book. And it is. It's a 470-page tribute to this warrior of a human being who is my mum. You know, we don't have time to go into why she is that, but I tell you, man. And then I sent it to her. I said, look, you need to read this, because of just what I said before, is like, I'm never, ever in my life ever going to do something where my own ambition and my own kind of, you know, ego gets in the way of relationships with the people I love. And that's a really dicey thing. I'm already treading a fine knife edge line with that, and it really bothers me, and I lose sleep at night, to be honest with you, about that. But she reads it, I swear to God, man, she said, Trent, I started reading it last night, I had to take a day off work, and she said, Trent, it's beautiful and it's bigger than us, and I think you're going to actually give something to a lot of people. And I was like, oh man, I'm getting emotional just thinking about it. It was so beautiful. And then my brothers, I've got three older brothers. I'm like, guys, you need to do it now. You need to read this. And then they're all like, Trent, what the hell have you done? And it's like, so cool. And so that's a win right there, man. That was amazing. Then Catherine Milne, I was doing a job. Catherine Milne, head of fiction at HarperCollins Australia, calls up and says, Trent, guess what? we're selling this freaking thing to 32 countries around the world. It's going to be freaking translated into Hebrew. There's going to be like things about your little suburb, Brisbane, Queensland, Australia. Words like Dara and Bracken Ridge and you know, Jackie Howe singlet and medium pace bowling and, you know, mullet gut, fishing mullet gut, you know, Hornybrook Bridge, light up a durry. You know, all of this stuff is going to be translated into all these different languages. And this whole, this story about this place that is dear to me, Brisbane, and my life is all just going to go around the world and people might even read about it. You know, it's so, man, that, so there's been all those little milestone moments and they've all been wild. Every single one of them. The first email from Catherine, mum's call, my brother's, then this global stuff. Sitting here talking to you. You know what I mean? I seriously mean that. It's freaking beautiful. I'm so grateful. Because I know what else I could have been doing. You know, it's very, very meaningful to me.
And that is it for this week's Writer's Routine. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard, please do leave us a review on Apple Podcasts if that's how you are listening to the show. Also, make sure you subscribe wherever you're finding us. Oh, if you're not on Apple Podcasts, actually, here's something you could do. Just tweet about the show. We've had a couple of really nice blog reviews written about the show recently. Thank you so much if you took the time to write down some words about what we do and share it with all of your mates, everyone in your writing community. I'd love more of that. I'd love just to hear what you think about the show. You can do that on Apple Podcasts or you can do it via tweet. Now, next week, we're chatting to a psychological thriller writer, someone who's really mastered the genre and really mastered the art of selling an ebook. That's on the way next week on Writer's Routine. Until then, keep in touch with us through Twitter. We are Writer's Pod there. On Instagram, we are Writer's Routine. And you can find everything about the show on our website, which is writersroutine.com. I will see you next week with Mel Sherritt on Writer's Routine. Bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.